Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, and we have a discussing episode today. We're going to be discussing a play. We're going to be discussing performance. We're going to be what happens when you take a play and you try to turn it into performance in a specific context with specific people. And they are interesting specific people who will tell you specifically about themselves. So my wonderful guests, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, I'm Allison Pager. I'm one of the co-artistic directors of AMP Theatre Company.
And I am Mark Pager, and I am also one of the co-artistic directors of AMP Theatre Company.
So, tell us about AMP. Why does AMP exist? Why does the world need an AMP?
AMP Theatre Company is based in South Bend, Mishawaka, Indiana. South Bend is a mid-sized city in the Midwest. Anyone who's heard of Notre Dame might know where we are. The metropolitan area of South Bend has about 300,000 people. And AMP Theatre Company, we're a community theater. We're focusing on community and connection. And we are producing shows using original early modern staging practices, which means we're focusing on shared lighting, where the audience and the actors are in the same level of lighting. We're not plunging the audience into darkness during the shows, which allows for us to have direct address with the audience, where actors are taking lines to the audience and making them part of a conversation in the play itself. And we're also working with very simple sets. We don't bring in a lot of extra large set pieces. We work mostly just with bodies on stage. If you want to know more about AMP Theatre Company, you can always check out our website, amptheatrecompany.org. Mark, do you have anything you want to add about AMP?
Yeah. I mean, the production we'll be talking about today was our first production. We've both been doing a lot of early modern drama, and that's kind of our bread and butter and what we wanted to do more of. So that's another reason that we decided to start this company. And we have a history of using original practices, doing early modern drama.
Mark and I met at Mary Baldwin University doing our graduate work. We were both studying at a program called Shakespeare in Performance. So we were very deeply immersed in early modern drama. We had the great opportunity of studying and producing shows on the Blackfriars stage, one of the only recreations of the indoor playhouses, that just kind of really gave us the opportunity to dive into those early modern practices and like the shared lighting and see just how much connection you can get out of that with the audience. And it's a very different experience than most modern theater patrons are used to.
And very different from what tends to be produced in our area, which is a big part of, you know, like to us, it's like, naturally, that's how you do these plays. Of course, why would you do them any other way? Not quite why would you do them any other way, but they were written that way, written for that style of performance. And they really kind of shine when you do it that way. And so we're excited to be able to do theater the way that we want to do it here in town.
So we're here specifically to talk about a production based on the play Musidorus, which is, for the listeners at home, a fun-filled, rollicking adventure with polar bears. one of a sequence of plays that I wouldn't quite call it a sequence, but there's more than one play that features a polar bear doing fun things. We've recently looked at The Old Wives' Tale, which you never see him, but he technically turns into a bear at night. I hope there's a version out there somewhere where he does actually do that at some point, but alas, doesn't. But Musidorus is a play that comes in different versions. There is a play with additions from the King's Men repertoire. There is an earlier iteration of the play, and I think that's the one that you zoomed in on. So before we actually get to the production itself, there's sort of that question of how do you get to, even to the point where you actually rehearse with actors, because you have a script. What are you going to be doing with that? What are your processes in terms of that prep work for getting to the stage?
Sure. So when we were first brainstorming ideas of plays that we wanted to produce, one of the plays we were interested in was actually Climen and Calamities, which has a similar vibe where it's knights and adventure and all those sorts of things. But when we looked at that particular script, we felt like the language in that one was a little more archaic feeling.
And it's perhaps... got 14ers, you see. That's what it's got. It's got those wonderful 14ers. I'm a great champion of 14ers, so I will hear nothing against them. But no, I get your point.
But yeah, just the meter in that one was so strong that we knew we'd be working with a lot of people who might not have much training in performing early modern drama. And my experience having worked as a text coach on early modern drama is one of the biggest pitfalls people can fall into is the sous spot, where they fall into the meter and just can't seem to break out of it. And so as much as we liked the story of Climate and Calamities, we were like, we felt like this was a play for later down the road. So Mark had actually reached out to you and the Beyond community for suggestions of plays that had a similar vibe as Climate and Calamities, but were perhaps a bit more accessible as far as the meter and language of the play. And that's where Musidorus came up. And so we started looking at that. And Mark, I'll let you talk about kind of how we prepared the script itself for production.
Yeah, we've built this play as the first in our adventure series, so we probably will return to Climate and Calamities at some point. I have acted in a production of it, and so I know that the language can be very fun. But yeah, as we were looking at those rhyming 14ers for the eternity of the play, we were like, that'll be in the future.
Yes, because it is a fundamentally longer text as well than Musidorus. Musidorus is actually quite manageable, whereas it's quite an epic, actually.
So, right, the length of the play and the number of actors needed, it's great to go shorter and smaller for our first production. So that made this a really great first text. We did indeed start with the version without additions, which, in my opinion, just reads like a better play in general. But specifically, for an audience that doesn't know the reveal, spoilers. Musidorus is a prince. The play doesn't give that away, the version without additions. The play doesn't give that away until he reveals it to the other actors on stage twice late in the play. And that's a great moment. And so for an audience like ours, who largely has no idea anything about this play, which is going to be true for most modern audiences for this play, that's great to have that reveal be a reveal, be able to lean into that reveal.
Yes, you get that sense with the additions that because the play's been in rep for 10 plus years that they've gone, everybody knows this now. Let's start with that and do something with it.
It very much read to us like it was the like deleted scenes that you get on like the Blu-ray release of a movie where it's like, you know, he's a prince, but why did he choose to do this?
And like most deleted scenes, there's a reason they're deleted. They're fun to know once you know the play, but it's better. It's got a better flow, better structure without him. So that was the starting point. We made some cuts throughout. There's the induction with Comedy and Envy. We cut that completely. Otherwise, we made small cuts, but they were small. The play ran about an hour and 10 minutes, all told, in performance. Some of the cuts were just, we don't really need this here, we don't really need that there. But we leaned into keeping things rather than cutting them. One thing that we did is we tweaked some things. It started with some of the more archaic language. Some of the things that people who read a lot of early modern drama are very accustomed to, like the word "an" being a replacement often for "if." And a lot of those, I'm like, I'll just change that to "if." There's no reason that it needs to be "an." Nothing against productions that keep it as "an," but it doesn't need to be. It can just be "if." And then the word, and this comes up so much in Climate and Calamities too, so I was familiar with it from this, but the word "white," W-I-G-H-T, to refer to like a person or being. I was like, we don't need that. Like, it just sounds weird. So let's change that to, you know, whatever is needed with the line, you know, whatever makes sense in the that particular line. Otherwise, we made some adjustments for the jokes. So a lot of the humor in this play, and this is Allison and I reading it out loud as we were first considering doing it, we were like, this is so funny. And the character Mouse, in particular, the clown character in the play, is extremely funny, and it reads as funny now, for the most part. But there were some jokes that it was like, the structure of this joke is fantastic, but it relies on language that we don't use in the same way anymore.
Isn't there a reference to an Emmett at some
point?
Yes.
Yes.
It's what do you do with that joke? Because it's not a bad joke, as you're saying. It's structurally fine. It's just no one in the audience has a clue what an Emmett is.
Yeah. Right. Mark did a great job revising that joke for the
So, here it is in the original script. You have Musidorus, who here is disguised as a hermit, and the clown Mouse is running into him, and Musidorus is trying to be in hiding and not have his identity revealed.
You want to be Musidorus or Mouse?
I'll be Mouse.
Great.
What art thou?
I am a hermit.
An Emmett? I never saw such a big Emmett in all my life before.
We haven't explained actually what an Emmett is. It's an ant.
Yes, Emmett is an ant. And so it's like, that's a great joke because, you know, especially in certain accents, you know, that can kind of work, hermit and Emmett sounding similar.
Because the H might not be pronounced, so it would be more hermit sort
exactly.
of logic.
So it's close, but we don't know what an Emmett is. We don't use that word anymore to refer to an ant. And so the joke we replaced it with is, and this is slightly anachronistic because this term, it looks like, dates from about the 18th century, but we just use the term hermit crab, a different type of small creature. So the joke in our version is, Mouse asks, what art thou?
I am a hermit.
A hermit crab? I never saw such a big crab in all my life before. Etc.
Same joke, different form.
Yes, exactly. And that joke comes back when Mouse and one of Sagasto's other servants are speaking. And Sagasto's like, you never found Amadine and the shepherd? And Mouse says, I've been through the woods and through the woods and could find nothing but a crab instead of an Emmett. And then the other servant in the original script says, why, I see a thousand Emmetts. That means a little one. And so he's like saying, like, there's ants all over the place. What are you talking about? But when it comes to crabs, I couldn't not lean into a different sort of joke there, which is...
Rimbello now responds, why, I'm certain you have thousands of little crabs.
Very early modern, even if we're slightly twisting what language might have been used.
Exactly.
That's fine.
It's the kind of joke you would expect in an early modern play. And then another joke in there was because the hermit, Musidorus is the hermit in the earlier scene, has to explain. It's like, no, I'm a hermit. I'm not a, you know, ant or a crab or whatever you're calling me in this iteration. I'm one who leads a solitary life about the woods. And in the original scripts later, Mouse is recounting this to Sagasto. And he says he did lead a salt cellar's life about the woods. And I'm not sure exactly where the joke is there, but I was like, there's a joke here about him mishearing the word solitary. Mm. And so we decided to change that to solid dairy. A solid dairy life about the woods. And then Sagasto having to kind of work through the stupidity of a servant to be like, oh, you mean a solitary life about the woods. So that's just a few places. And there were like a couple other places in the play, but not that many, where it was like the humor with Mouse is so good, but with just like a little tweak, it'll work better for a modern audience. Still keeping the same structure of the joke, but with a mild change.
Yes, because certainly a lot of early modern clown patter, certainly up until the Jacobean, is basically mishearing jokes. Is that, you know, somebody's being terribly pompous and serious, and they'll come on and just get things deliberately wrong. It sort of is elaborated from the town crier shtick, where a town crier comes on, or someone has an address to make, and the official town crier does the repeating really loudly for them. But of course, it's the clown, so he gets it wrong every time, and the poor man is going, nope, that's not what I said.
It's like, it's really funny stuff. If done right, and then, yeah, in some instances, you know, in my experience from this play, it's like, if the words no longer sound like each other, or if the word that it's sounding like is no longer a word we use, then if we can just make a small tweak, then it's still the same. It's in the spirit of this, of the original joke, but can play a lot better for the modern ear.
Yes, because of the thing that, and anyone who's out there going, oh, well, you shouldn't change any words, you should keep it exactly the same. This is a comedy. You can be terribly obscure in a tragedy, because the audience doesn't have to do a damn thing apart from sit there and be sad. with a comedy, the audience has to laugh, otherwise you have really failed. And so these kinds of tweaks and adjustments, and let's be clear also, even we all make changes to scripts. It happens all the time. It does depend on the spirit, and sometimes people go too far and throw the baby out with the bathwater. But, you know, minor tweaks to jokes, minor word switcheroos, as long as you're keeping the verse relatively, you know, where it is in verse. I don't know if the clown's is in verse a lot of the time.
Yeah,
probably in prose.
Like, all in prose. So it's like, these are easy changes.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise, when it's in verse, it's a little trickier, certainly.
So that's any more on the script?
Yes, we have a lot more on the script. One place where we did throw the baby out with the bathwater intentionally, there's a speech that Musidorus has to the wild man, cannibal, Brimo, to try to explain why Brimo should not immediately kill him and eat him. And in the original script, he has this whole thing about, like, oh, humans used to be savages, but then Orpheus arrived and led them to civilization, something along those lines. And I was not a fan of it for various reasons. Just the message of, like, humans used to be savages and now they're not is just, like, something I'm not a historian, but I just don't historically agree with. The thing is, the speech is, it doesn't work. Brimo's like, yeah, let's fight each other at the end of it. And so that can be done, I think, in a funny way where it's like Musidorus tries to make this big dramatic speech and then it doesn't work because it's a bad argument. But we decided in this particular instance to just completely change the script. And what we did was we had Musidorus, and it was somewhat subtle at first and then became more and more obvious that it was song lyrics from various modern songs about peace and working together. And I actually don't have it in front of me at all.
I do.
Great. Yeah, do you just want to read it?
Sure. So the line immediately preceding is Brimo saying, "Speak on, but be not over long." And Musidorus replies, "What, should we fight before we have a cause? Why cannot we be friends? There comes a time when we do heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. Imagine, Brimo, no need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. We're all in this together, and it shows when we stand hand in hand, make our dreams come true. And we can build this dream together, standing strong forever, for there is nothing that can stop us now. I'll fight for thee." And then Brimo comes in, "Fight for me or die."
And yeah, by this point in the play, we've already established kind of our tone, which we'll get into in a moment. But yeah, one thing that was just so funny in performance of hearing people hear this speech is that depending on the songs people happen to know, they start laughing at different points in the speech. And it just starts bubbling up at different points where it's like a lot of the first couple in there people weren't recognizing. But then by the time you get to imagine all the people sharing all the world, a lot of people are getting it. Mm. And then we go into High School Musical song, and then different demographics of the audience start laughing. Yeah, it all came together really well.
Again, for any listeners questioning this approach, it is actually, again, a perfectly early modern, nay, possibly even going back medieval approach, where a nonsense song will be pulled together from just random lyrics will be thrown one after the other, after the other, after the other, by a clown. So that, again, it has period precedent, even if the text is not. And again, it's a silly comedy. Really? Really?
Right.
I don't know why I'm arguing with this fake person who's having an objection. I just like to preempt it. You know, you can disagree. Please at us in some fashion on social media. I love passive-aggressive abuse. It's great.
Well, and yeah, that's the thing. I would love to see a production that keeps that as is and what they would do with it. But it's not what we decided to do with this particular production. And then just in terms of tone, and again, this kind of fitting in with the tone that we were establishing early on, we were going for a pretty over-the-top tone.
Yeah.
And it starts really with how we manage the fights. So there were three fights in our production. The first one in the original script is off stage, which is Musidorus' fight with the bear. We staged that, and what we did was we did over dramatic slow motion, like movie style slow motion for the fight.
Yeah.
And you get moments of people going like, "No," and such.
Part of that is we enjoyed the comedy of taking the cinematic slow motion trope and kind of implanting that into an early modern play. We liked that juxtaposition. But some of the reasoning for the slow motion fights was also born out of practicality. Mm-hmm. We were working in a very small space with actors who do not have extensive fight combat, stage combat training. And neither Mark nor I are certified fight directors. So just for practical safety purposes, we were like, if it's slow, it is safe. And so not only did it lend itself to comedy of slow motion, but it also let us work in a very safe and confident way with all of our cast on those fights.
Yes, especially as, you know, it's a comedy with quite a lot of violence actually in it, and, mm-hmm. and violence with consequences, which is unusual for a comedy. Right. You know, it's unusual for actual death to occur in a comedy. But, you know, hey.
Right, and it definitely does. And yes. And I think part of what made the slow motion kind of style work really well comedically is that we had three fights, rule of threes. And we had people talk to us about that afterwards, that it's like, oh, once the final fight started, the third, it's like, okay, this has been a thing, and now it's coming back for this big dramatic moment at the end. And that's with Remo. And so that was one of the other changes we made from the scripts, because we like this idea of having these three slow motion fights. In the original scripts, Musidorus basically tricks Remo into handing over the club. And Remo's like, all you got to do is hit somebody in the head to take him out. And then Musidorus is like, great, thwack, takes him out. Which is hilarious. It's very funny. But so we kept that, but it didn't quite take him out. He gets dazed by it, and that starts the final slow motion fight. One thing we enjoyed about that is that it allowed, while still having that initial thwack from Musidorus, it allowed us to have a moment where at the end of the fight, Remo is in slow motion, like, starting to strangle Musidorus, who's on his knees.
Remo is very clearly the one with the upper hand in the fight, and it's right. not going well for Musidorus at this point in the way that we staged it.
And then Amadeen grabs the club, smack, boom, out of slow motion. He's down. He's down for the count. So yeah, we'll talk in a moment about some other script tweaks we made for Amadeen specifically, and with Amadeen's place in the play, which will lead into part of why we renamed our version of it, which didn't change that much from the scripts, but just for like marketing purposes, we feel like this sounds better anyway. Amadeen and Musidorus. Mm. Partly, Amadeen is a cooler name than Musidorus, so, you know, start with that one.
I felt really strongly about giving Amadeen more agency in the play. That we've got this princess who is present throughout the entire play. She's there for two out of the three fights. She, you know, she has to face off with a bear, and while she wasn't involved in that fight, she is present for it. And yeah, reading it, as is often the case for female characters in early modern drama, she doesn't have much agency in the original text. But we still felt like there was potential for Amadeen to be a, you know, strong female character in this play. So we had made some revisions to the text in order to give agency back to Amadeen. And one of the places we did that is, like Mark said, we had her involved in taking out Brimo, which also meant we had to revise some of the lines after that fight where, you know, in the original text, Musidorus is just saying, like, now that you're free. And we had to revise some of those lines to reflect the fact that she had taken part in.
Yeah, he says, like, now that I have freed you, along those lines.
Something like that. But yeah, some of the places where we, like, really kind of intervened in the text to give choice back to Amadeen was in the final scene. Musidorus in the original text has a line saying, so hath your daughter my partaker been, as you shall know hereafter more at large. Desiring you, you will give her to me, even as my own and sovereign of my life, then shall I think my travels are well spent. And the fact that Musidorus is asking for the king to give his daughter to him, the undercurrent of women as property, I was not a fan of this. So we ended up revising that and reassigning that part of that line to Amadeen. Musidorus has been talking about, like, why he came in disguise as a shepherd. And then Amadeen comes in and says, so hath your daughter his partaker been, as you shall know hereafter more at large. Meantime, we ask that you do bless our union. And then Musidorus comes back in with, when Amadeen is sovereign of my life, then shall I think my travels are well spent. So only one line really truly had significant change there. And it was us taking the line about giving Amadeen to Musidorus and instead changing that to asking the king for his blessing on their marriage. Mm. Again, just feeling like it gives Amadine voice in that moment, that she's the one saying she wants to be with Musidorus. She said it throughout the play, but I felt like it was important in that final scene to hear that again from her. And then the other scene where we did a line reassignment to get Amadine more involved is after Musidorus and Amadine have both been captured by Brimo and have been living in his cave. They're having a conversation and Brimo comes in and is like, what's all this whispering about? And in the original text, Musidorus alone comes up with this long explanation lie of what they've been talking about. And part of that lie that he concocts is like, Amadine's been saying these things where she's all worried about you. And it's like in quotations that, you know, shall my sweet Brimo wander through the woods, toil to and fro for to redress my wants, so on and so forth, quoth she. And so I asked Mark, I was like, why can't that be Amadine coming up with what she was saying at that moment?
So that they're working together and it's like he's passing the ball over and you said this, did I?
Oh, yeah.
Words.
Yeah, exactly. So it made them a team rather than him working solely to help her. And our actor playing Amadine did a great job selling that as like, I'm making up things that I have said. So yeah, those were two of the moments where we like really intervened in the text to move lines over to Amadine so that she is more involved.
Because that's one of two of the challenges actually about dealing with texts of this period is the structural sense of actually just give it, when you hire an actor, giving them more to do when if their part is not necessarily as large as you'd like it to be, but also just dealing with those structural problems that a modern audience isn't going to buy in the same way. And there are various different strategies and ways of framing these things, but that seems like all of those decisions are very carefully thought through so that they're not going against the text. But more importantly, in that last instance you just gave there, is it also adds enjoyment. That makes that scene do something quite interesting and quite fun, whereas actually that speech can be a bit of a slog for one actor. So it's
right.
It's really giving your actors something to do, and that's always what I'm looking for in a script. Mark will know right. this from exploring sessions. He's constantly going, has the actors got something to play with there, or are they just standing around doing nothing?
Yeah, and reassigning that little section to Amadine, it made it a true like back and forth between them, because Musidorus starts it, it jumps over to Amadine, and then he comes in with the end of that speech. So we took the middle section and moved it over to Amadine.
Yeah, and we have like each of them on opposite sides of the stage with Brimo in between, just kind of like, you know, thinking through what they're saying and whether it's believable. And it there's a lot more drama to it when they're both trying to scramble for an explanation about what they're talking about.
But yeah, we very much wanted the audience to root for Amadine and Musidorus as a couple. Like, we were building in moments of, you know, that spark and chemistry right from the get-go, when right after Musidorus beheads a bear on stage.
It's quite a meet cute, isn't it?
Yeah, quite the meet cute. But anyway, so like even in that first scene, we're like building in moments for the audience to start seeing them falling in love with each other. And we were doing a lot in rehearsal to build that relationship between the two of them and make it something that the audience is really rooting for, because I think they need to, especially when you title the play Amadine and Musidorus. When you put both of them in the title, you kind of want the audience to be rooting for those title characters.
Right. And it's worth noting that a lot of people just refer to the play as Musidorus, but like the original title of the play, like so many early modern original titles, was like 40 words long or something. Plus, and it did include both of their names.
The copy that I have pulled up here is A Most Pleasant Comedy of Musidorus, the King's Son of Valencia, and Amadine, the King's Daughter of Aragon.
Yeah, it's like they are both in the title.
with the merry conceits of Mouse.
Yeah,
of course.
But yeah, when we were talking about what do we want our production to be titled, I think, Mark, you were one saying, like, does it really need to have Musidorus's name in there? It sounds like cold medicine. And I think I was the one that was really pushing for us to keep Musidorus's name. But then we finally decided if we add Amadine's name at the beginning, it's more clear that those are two names they are connected to each other, which gestures towards the romance plot of the play.
Yeah, it's great for marketing because it much more, especially because we have our little adventure series like little logo thrown on there, and I'm like, between seeing two names that like sounds like a romance, and then seeing adventure series, it's like that was really selling what we were selling with this play, with it being a fun romantic adventure with these two leads. And everyone they encounter,
and unless you're a polar bear fan, in which case it doesn't go so well.
Doesn't go so well for the bear.
Not so good for the bear, or Bremo, or quite a few.
And yeah, we did have the bear on stage. It was one of our actors in a fur onesie with a bear hat, and then during our slow motion fight, Musidorus takes the sword across the back of the head and pulls the hat off. And then it was a sock that I had cut into strips that dangles down like little bloody bits hanging off of the actor's head to cover up his face. Yeah.
And it was the same actor who would later play Bremo, which becomes fitting.
It's always good to kill the same actor multiple times. Audiences love that. If you can get it up to three or four, then the audience really starts twigging as well. Of going, oh, you're going to keep killing him every time. Oh my God, they've killed Bremo. You
and and we decided to pronounce it Bremo in our production.
I'm not going to say that my pronunciation is as you will know. I will say it a different way every time if I can.
Just like Musidorus or Musidorus is like both of them sound terrible. It either sounds like cold medicine or it sounds like he's a moose.
In that instance, that definitely is Musidorus.
Great.
Because I went to a conference on it once. and I remember that takeaway. Because of the source material where it comes from as well.
Just one other moment where we had to kind of make a script change for practical reasons is when Bremo has died. Our actor was laying on the ground. And we're doing, again, like original practices. It's not like we're doing lights off and then the actor gets up and walks off.
And if we were on an early modern stage, we would have a discovery space with curtains that we could drop.
And maybe he just happens to fall back there as he gets taken out. And then the curtains drop and then he walks away.
We didn't have a discovery space. We just had a stage.
Well, also, there's no guarantee you'd get that on tour. So, you know, you've always got to work on the assumption that you're performing in a space of some description. And with the earlier iteration as well, there's no guarantee. You're much more likely to be in a different potential space than the Kingsmen later on, who have obviously a much more London focused. And anyway, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent.
What we ultimately landed on was like, okay, let's make a joke about the fact that he's not actually dead. He gets up and he's like, oh, like he clearly his head hurts a lot. You know, there's a victory in him being defeated. He's a cannibal who's like killing everyone he meets. You want that victory of defeating him to still be there. So again, just one of the few like just completely anachronistic but fun lines we threw in there is just Bremo after like standing up and like holding his head in pain. He goes, Bremo going vegetarian, and walks off the stage as a fun, silly way to defang him as the play goes to its conclusion.
Yeah, because we had already dealt with how do we get Tremelio's body off stage. Again, having to, the space that we were working in, it was essentially like a storefront lobby type space. So we had a couple entrances and exits, but not much space. And we had two actors who had to get Tremelio off stage, and it ended up being a bit of a Weekend at Bernie's walk off the stage. And we had considered, do we try to do something similar with Bremo? And we're like, we've already used that joke once. I don't think it's going to play again. So yeah, we had to pivot and come up with another solution for getting Bremo off the stage.
So we've sort of done, from script, we've sort of danced into the performance thing. But in terms of how getting it on stage, the rehearsal process that you had, I mean, did you use cue scripts? You were saying you were doing original practices those kinds of things. How much time prep and what was your process?
So we did not use cue scripts. Maybe someday down the road we'll introduce that original practice to everybody. I've done it. It's fun. You make some fun discoveries that way. But no, we did not use cue scripts. We had, Mark, it was about 6 weeks of rehearsal, right?
Yes, 6 weeks total, including the final week into performances.
So we had 6 weeks of rehearsal, and we rehearsed three nights a week. Again, because we're operating as a community theater, and Mark and I were very intentional about making sure that we are able to balance the time commitment we're asking of our volunteer actors and balancing that with their real life commitments outside of the rehearsal room. And not that rehearsal isn't real life, but other life commitments. So yeah, we felt like three nights a week allows us a good amount of time to really dive in and do the work, but also affords our actors time to live their lives outside of the rehearsal room. We had to do a little bit of casting shuffling. The actor that we originally cast for Amadine had to bow out of the play. And so we recast Amadine, but weren't able to get that actor until about halfway through rehearsals. So our early rehearsal process ended up being very focused on the mouse comedy. We spent a lot of time really early on investing in Mouse and Sagasto and a lot of those storylines.
Yeah, those were the scenes that we had all of the actors available for. So it's like, and getting that comedy right is really important. So
yes, and that is the trickier comedy business, in the sense that it's someone doing comedy, and if they do comedy and it's not funny, you're in trouble. Whereas the other stuff has humor in it,
right?
But it's situational, and therefore if you're not getting the laughs, you can sort of ride it until the next funny bit.
Right.
So yeah, that in a sense that's the best way to do it, he said.
Yeah, so it ended up working out really well because we were able to invest the time early on into Mouse, and then once we finally had Amadine in the rehearsal room, we were like, we gotta really spend some time on Amadine and Musidorus and Brimo scenes. But we were still running the Mouse Sagasto scenes, but by that point we had reached a stage where we could just say, oh, here, tweak this and that. Like, here's some notes, but not having to spend hours finessing and fine-tuning those scenes.
Like, when we were scheduling it, we were like, this might feel like a small amount of rehearsal compared to, like, what a lot of the other community theaters in town do. But especially knowing that it is a shorter play, you know, if you do, for example, an hour-long play versus a two-hour play, you only need half the rehearsal. You know, it's half of the minutes of business to be working at, essentially. So it seemed very doable, and it absolutely was.
Yeah, I think we kind of did the math on what our rehearsal time was in comparison to performance. And I think the math turned out to almost exactly 1 hour rehearsal for every 1 minute of stage time.
So in terms of producing it, I mean, who was doing with, were you acting in it or were you projecting it? I've actually forgotten to check what your actual production roles were in this thing.
Yeah, so for this production, Mark and I were co-directors. Neither of us were in the production, like on stage, but we were sharing the directing responsibilities, which worked out really well for us. That there were scenes where, you know, one of us would be a little more heavy-handed in the direction, and then there were other times that it was a very even split.
Yeah, because, yeah, this was the first production that our company was doing. Small cast, we had 8 actors. And so we decided not to try to get like a stage manager or anything else. So we really did all the production things ourselves, which when we're co-directors and can lean on each other for our directing work and other aspects of it helps. You know, it's like, oh, Allison's doing costumes for people for half an hour when I'm doing, you know, monologue work with one of the actors, or Allison's doing work with one of the actors while I'm off doing something else.
Yeah.
So you get to performance. How did it go? I mean, you obviously heard the noises the audience make and you listened to the lies that your friends told you. How did it go? In so much as you can know from your own personal experience.
Yeah, it was really well received. We had over 100 people come to the show over the course of 3 performances. So it was well attended. A lot of people commented about how well the comedy translates to today that a lot of people were really impressed with how funny it was.
Yeah.
I think people were pleasantly surprised.
It went really well. So it was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We just did 1 week of performances for this first production. And for the Sunday, we had a matinee, whereas the other two were in the evening. And we had very few tickets pre-sold for the Sunday. So we were expecting a very small crowd. And we were like, oh, yeah, like, this is going to be, you know, very little attendance. And a lot of people showed up, a lot more than had pre-bought tickets before that day. And yeah, so hopefully that's a sign that, you know, word of mouth was doing its work. And in the future, if we do 2 weekends of performances, you know, we'll be able to see more of that potentially of, you know, people having time to tell other people to come see the show and having another week to see it.
Yes, that's the problem with word of mouth. You do need time for people to actually utilize their mouths and ears. Do you think you would return to Musidorus, or are you thinking of pastures new?
We like build this as the first in our adventure series, and we're not going to do another show that we're building as adventure series as our next show or even the show after that. But the idea of like the kind of vibes of fun and silly and adventurous that people got from this production, we're planning to find all the other plays we can, early modern plays that we can, to be able to have something similar enough that people are like, oh yeah, I really enjoyed the last adventure series play. Let's do another one. This play specifically, I don't think we have any plans to go back to anytime soon. Partly because, as you know, I have been especially exposed to doing the Beyond Shakespeare Exploring sessions so much recently. There are so many good plays from the time period. We're currently planning to do maybe two shows for the calendar year after we did this one show. You know, if we were to continue at that rate, we have too many plays to do. no immediate need to return to the same play because there's just so many good options.
There's so many options.
There's a really interesting thing about the early modern period in terms of actually trying to label things with what we might consider modern genres.
Yeah.
Because the way things are labeled are not necessarily very helpful for audiences today, and deciding what constitutes a genre today, and do the overlaps perfectly work? Do you need to tweak things? You know, in the sense you've made relatively minor tweaks to make it really fit within that sweet spot in terms of how you sell it and making sure the audience knows, because the audience does need to know what they're coming to see before they come to see it, unless they're openly coming to something they don't know about and just going, hey, I'm going to find out what happens. And if you get that wrong, then you can get into a lot of trouble. He speaks from bitter experience. any final thoughts or things about the production and your works to date that you want to throw in before I close?
Yeah, I was going to say, Mark, do we want to talk about what's next?
We can mention our next production.
Yeah.
Not sure when this is going live, but
yeah.
The production, you can do it, Elsa.
Thank you. So we just recently locked in the dates for our next production, and spring of 25, we'll be producing Galatea by John Lilly.
John Lilly action in spring. Well, this podcast will definitely drop before spring 2025, or at least I will endeavour to make sure it goes out before that happens. But of course, people may be listening to this in the future.
Yeah.
So do check for any plugs that people give for things that may be quite a long time in the past. So do check the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'll say if you want to know what else we're up to, you know, whether you're, you know, living somewhere where it's practical to get to the Midwest United States or not, if you're just curious what shows we're doing, yeah, our website is amptheatercompany.org, and we intend to have a history of the shows that we have done in addition to information about upcoming productions on that website.
And links will be in the show description if a Google search is just too much like work. unless there's anything else, I'm going to say thank you very much to my wonderful guests. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.